Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella. As mentioned, my name is Johnny Nazarian. I am the Education Program Manager here at Cancer Care, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Progress in the Treatment of Endometrial Cancer. This program is done in collaboration with Share Cancer Support. We want to thank them for being on this call today and our continued partnership. This activity is supported by ESI Inc. and was made possible through an independent grant from Rick & Co. Inc. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, to start, I just want to let you know how many people we have on the call. We have over 200 participants on the call today, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from the United Kingdom, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have all of you on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Deborah Richardson. Dr. Richardson is professor and section chief gynecologic oncology at the University of Oklahoma Health Campus. And Dr. Richardson will be discussing an overview of endometrial cancer, including diagnosis and staging, as well as current standard of care and new treatment approaches. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Richardson.
Thanks so much for the kind introduction. I'm very happy to be here today with you all to discuss endometrial cancer. Most women with endometrial cancer present with abnormal vaginal bleeding. There is no screening test for endometrial cancer. Endometrial cancer is typically diagnosed by an endometrial biopsy, which is a biopsy of the lining of the uterus, either in the office, or we can do what's called a hysteroscopy and a dilation and curettage in the operating room. And a hysteroscopy is where we dilate the cervix and we place a camera inside the uterus to look around. Endometrial cancer is graded depending on several things that the pathologist will see under the microscope. And basically, endometrioid is the most common type of endometrial cancer, and that is graded as 1 or low grade, 2, which is in the middle, although if we go to a 2 categorization, then it's low grade, which would encompass 1 and 2, and then grade 3. There are also other subtypes of uterine cancer, which include serous carcinosarcoma and clear cell. Most commonly, imaging, for example, CT scans, are only done if the patient has a high grade or higher risk types of those endometrial cancer, those ones I just mentioned, like serous and carcinosarcoma. Most women with endometrial cancer will undergo surgery. And in the United States, that's mostly going to be a robotic-assisted hysterectomy, which means removing the uterus and the cervix, removing both tubes and ovaries, or what's called a salpingo-oophorectomy, and then a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And a sentinel lymph node biopsy is done by once a person is brought to the operating room and put under anesthesia, we inject this dye called ICG into the cervix at the time of surgery, with the idea being that this will go to the first draining lymph node, and that if that lymph node is negative, the remainder of the lymph node should be negative. If that lymph node is positive, then that means that the patient has a stage 3. A full lymph node dissection may be done. Stage is assigned after the pathology results. So one of the more common questions I get when I'm meeting a new patient is they want to know what stage they are, but we don't usually know that when we're first meeting a patient. We don't find that out until after we do our surgery and get pathology back. In general, stage 1 means confined to the uterus. Stage 2 means there's cervical involvement. Stage 3 can be involvement of the fallopian tube, ovary, or lymph nodes. Stage 4 means the cancer has spread or metastasized, for example, to the lungs or the liver. We used to group endometrial cancer into two categories, what we called type 1, or low grade, and type 2, which were the more aggressive cell types. But we're smarter now. We've learned more. And so now we use what's called molecular characterization. And so the tumor is tested for several biomarkers. And there are four categories. One is called POLE, which is P-O-L-E, and that is an ultra-mutated tumor. This is the least common group that we see. The next is mismatch repair deficiency. And basically, that is done by doing stains of the tumor for what we call the mismatch repair proteins and seeing if they're all present or if any are missing. If any are missing, the tumor is characterized as mismatch repair deficient. The next is P53 mutated. And the fourth is the most common, which is called NSMP, or no specific mutation phenotype. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Kerr, will go into this biomarker testing in more detail later during this presentation. While most endometrial cancer is spontaneous, about 5% of patients with endometrial cancer have a genetic cause, for example, Lynch syndrome. And to diagnose this, it requires a blood test, or what we call a germline test. And so some patients whose tumors are mismatch repair deficient on stains will be recommended to undergo this test. For early stage, some patients will not require any further treatment other than surgery. Some patients will be recommended to receive radiation, which most commonly in the United States at least will be brachytherapy, radiation to the top of the vagina. Typically, this is done in 3 visits, and it's usually pretty well tolerated. Those side effects can include bladder irritation or UTI-type symptoms, some bowel symptoms, and vaginal discomfort or pain. And after vaginal cuff brachytherapy, we do recommend dilator use. For patients with the higher risk histologies like serous, we do usually recommend chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. And some common side effects of these chemo include damaging the bone marrow, so we watch counts very carefully, blood counts, neuropathy, which can be numbness, tingling, or pain in the hands and feet, hair loss, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, and infusion reactions. For patients who are stage 3, they receive chemotherapy with carbo and Taxol for 6 cycles. For patients whose tumors are mismatch repair deficient in stage 3, we actually recommend now, this is new, adding a drug called pembrolizumab, or you may know it as Keytruda. And that's done because of a recent trial known as B21. And pembrolizumab is an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And what it does is it blocks the tumor's ability to communicate with your T cell or your immune cell, because the tumor will tell the immune cell, don't kill me, I'm not foreign. And by giving this drug, we can actually hopefully stimulate the immune system to recognize the cancer as foreign and kill it. Also, some high-grade endometrial cancers have overexpression of HER2-NU. So this is another biomarker that we test for. And so for more advanced stage uterine cancer, trastuzumab or Herceptin can be added to carbo and Taxol and then given as maintenance. We actually have a trial going on known as GY026, which is looking at this combination in more detail in stage 1 through 4 uterine cancer. And this trial has 3 arms, carbo and Taxol, carbo-Taxol Herceptin, or carbo-Taxol Herceptin pertuzumab, or Perjeta. And you do need to have an echo before you undergo treatment with Herceptin. And I'm now going to turn it back over to the organizers. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Richardson. That was a very comprehensive overview of endometrial cancer. You covered a lot of information in a short amount of time. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much again. And I'm going to introduce our next speaker. And our next speaker is Dr. Paulina Haight. Dr. Haight is the Assistant Professor, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the Ohio State University College of Medicine, the James Cancer Hospital, and Fellow Research Institute. Dr. Haight will be discussing new treatment for metastatic endometrial cancer, as well as the role of precision medicine, managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Haight.
Thank you, Johnny. Hi, everyone. It's really wonderful to be here talking with you all today. As Johnny mentioned, I'm going to start talking about new treatments for metastatic endometrial cancer. So metastatic endometrial cancer refers to a cancer that has spread beyond the uterus, the tubes and ovaries, and the lymph nodes. And this has very traditionally been treated with platinum-based chemotherapy or two drugs called carboplatin and paclitaxel. But we've seen really exciting news recently in the treatment landscape, and today treatment is not only based on where the cancer is located or whether it's metastasized, but also on the biology of the tumor. So as Dr. Richardson mentioned, we're now testing tumors for specific features, and those features help us determine treatments that are more personalized, or this is called precision medicine. And the biggest change to the standard of care for metastatic endometrial cancer treatment in most recent years has been immunotherapy. So for patients with newly diagnosed metastatic endometrial cancer, or stage 4 endometrial cancer, or for patients that have a new recurrence of their disease, the standard of care is now the addition of immunotherapy to traditional chemotherapy, and that's based on two very exciting clinical trials that were reported out in 2023 called GY018 and RUBY. And so pembrolizumab or dostarlimab are immunotherapy drugs that are added to carboplatin and paclitaxel that are given every 3 weeks. And the immunotherapy, as Dr. Richardson mentioned, you know, works by helping your immune system recognize and attack cancer cells. And I'll often tell my patients that cancer is able to grow because it really wears an invisibility cloak. And in doing so, it can evade the body's natural defense mechanism, which is the immune system. But immunotherapy sort of helps pull off that invisibility cloak, tells your body's immune system to recognize the cancer and to fight it. Immunotherapy works especially well for tumors that are mismatch repair deficient, and that's about 20% of endometrial cancers. Mismatch repair deficiency results from a genetic mutation that causes DNA replication errors in the tumor, and so this allows more DNA mistakes to build up over time in cancer cells, and that helps them to grow. And this genetic change, again, makes mismatch repair deficient tumors especially responsive to immunotherapy. But even for patients whose tumors do not have that feature of mismatch repair deficiency, adding immunotherapy to chemotherapy has still been shown to improve outcomes. For patients with recurrent disease or cancer that has already been treated and then comes back, and those tumors that are mismatch repair deficient, we can certainly treat with immunotherapy alone, knowing that based on their tumor biology, they tend to respond very well. If patients have recurrent disease that is not mismatch repair deficient, we can still give pembrolizumab, but we often will add a drug to that called lenvatinib, or Lenvima. Lenvima is a targeted therapy that blocks blood vessel growth that tumors need to survive. And the goal of the combination treatment is to enhance the efficacy of the immunotherapy for those patients whose tumors are not as genetically predisposed to having that excellent response to immunotherapy alone. Another important advance involves something called HER2, which Dr. Richardson mentioned. This is a protein on the surface of some cancer cells that helps them to grow. And you may have heard about this in breast cancer also, but we now know it's a really important molecular target for a subset of endometrial cancers. When a tumor is HER2 positive, it means that the cancer may respond to drugs that are designed to very specifically target that protein. And so one of the most exciting new treatments in the recurrent setting is called Enhertu, or trastuzumab deruxtecan. That's an antibody drug conjugate, and so that means it works sort of like a guided missile. One part of the drug recognizes and attaches to this HER2 protein on the cancer cell, and then the second part delivers a really powerful chemotherapy payload directly inside of that cell. And so as you can imagine, this allows for very targeted treatment and attacks cancer cells while limiting exposure of chemotherapy to normal cells, so thereby, you know, theoretically decreasing toxicity. So as you can see, you know, it's really important that we're performing these molecular tests on tumors in order to look for mismatch repair status, HER2 expression, and other genetic mutations that may allow for a tailored approach to treatment. The way that we discover these new treatments and their efficacy is through clinical trials, and, you know, so it's important to consider clinical trial eligibility when thinking about cancer treatment as well. I often will describe that to my patients as a way to receive tomorrow's treatment today. And, you know, this more personalized approach means that we are moving away from a one-size-fits-all treatment toward therapy that's chosen specifically based on the biology of each patient's cancer. But as treatment becomes more personalized, something else has changed too, and that's how we manage side effects and symptoms. So in the past, most patients received similar chemotherapy regimens, and the side effects from carboplatin and paclitaxel were pretty predictable: hair loss, nausea, fatigue, neuropathy, and low blood counts. And with immunotherapy drugs, the side effects are very different than traditional chemotherapy. Side effects occur because the immune system becomes more active, and that can lead to inflammation of essentially any organ, but most commonly the thyroid, colon, lungs, or skin. That can cause hyper or hypothyroidism, colitis, pneumonitis, or rash, to name a few. And the key there is early recognition, because when caught early, most of these immune-related side effects are very manageable, often with a temporary course of steroids or a pause or delay in treatment. With lenvatinib, we'll monitor for high blood pressure, diarrhea, fatigue, and appetite changes. These are often managed with dose adjustments of the lenvatinib, antihypertensive medications, antidiarrheals, and close follow-up. With HER2-directed therapies like Enhertu, the most common things people will experience are GI upsets, so nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and fatigue. But the more serious side effects we watch for are low blood counts and then inflammation of the lung or pneumonitis. And that can present as a cough, chest pain, shortness of breath, or low oxygen counts. And it's diagnosed based on a combination of physical exam and CT scan. It's treated with steroids and holding or stopping the drug in HER2. And the key here, again, is, you know, really early diagnosis, because that can be a very serious side effect, especially if it's recognized late, but is very treatable if recognized early. And the most important thing here is going to be talking with your doctors so you know what to look out for, and communicating with your oncology team if you're worried you're experiencing any of these side effects, because early detection and treatment is certainly going to lead to the best outcomes. And with that, I'll turn it over to Johnny.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haight. That was a superb presentation. You started with updates on treatment for metastatic endometrial cancer and moved your way to side effects. So thank you so much again. Just a wonderful presentation. Now I'm going to move on to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Paulina Ramirez. Dr. Ramirez is gynecology oncology fellow at UT Health San Antonio, and Dr. Ramirez will be discussing the role of targeted treatments in immunotherapy, clinical trials, how research increases treatment side effects, and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ramirez.
Thank you so much, Joni. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak today. I'm truly honored to be here, and I look forward to answering your questions at the end. Kind of an overlap of what Dr. Richardson and Dr. Haight's presentation was. Today, I'll be discussing two important topics. First, how targeted therapies, immunotherapy, and clinical trials are expanding treatment options for metastatic or recurrent endometrial cancer. Second, why managing side effects and communicating openly with your healthcare team is one of the most important parts of treatment. As we know, over the last several years, treatment for metastatic endometrial cancer has evolved significantly. Historically, most patients received cytotoxic chemotherapy, typically carboplatin and paclitaxel. Chemotherapy remains an important foundation of treatment. However, as Dr. Richardson and Dr. Haight mentioned earlier, we now understand that endometrial cancer is not just one disease. At a genetic level, tumors can behave very differently. This is where targeted therapy and immunotherapy come in. Targeted therapies are medications that are designed to focus on specific features of your cancer cells, instead of attacking all fast-growing cells like traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. Targeted therapies act on specific signals or proteins that help the cancer grow. To determine whether these treatments may help, we perform molecular testing, sometimes called next-generation sequencing, on a tumor sample. This allows us to analyze the tumor's DNA and protein expression, and helping us personalize your treatment. For example, as mentioned earlier, some metastatic endometrial cancers overexpress a protein called HER2. In those cases, medications that specifically target HER2 may be added to treatments such as Herceptin or Enhertu. These precision medicine matching therapy to the biology of the tumor. Immunotherapy works differently. Normally, your immune system is designed to detect and destroy abnormal cells, but cancer cells can hide. Immunotherapy helps remove the brakes that cancer uses to avoid immune detection. For patients with endometrial cancer, particularly those with mismatch repair deficiency, but also those who are not mismatch repair deficiency, respond especially well to immunotherapy, and it is now standard of care to add it to their treatment plan first line as well as maintenance. In recent years, as we've mentioned, the large clinical trials that have shown that adding immunotherapy has improved outcomes for all patients with endometrial cancer, with metastatic and recurrent specifically, as well. These advances did not happen overnight. They happened because of clinical research. In fact, every treatment we've considered standard today was once studied in a clinical trial. So clinical trials allow us to test new medications, new combinations, improve side effect management, and identify which patients benefit most. Participating in a clinical trial does not mean you are being experimented on. Clinical trials are carefully designed research studies built on years of prior scientific work and strict safety oversight. Clinical trials are how today's standard treatments become standard. In many cases, clinical trials provide access to promising new therapies that are not yet widely openly available. Research is how treatment options grow, and in endometrial cancer, those options are expanding because patients before you participated in this research, and that is so important. Now, I do want to shift my attention to something just as important as treatment itself, managing side effects and protecting quality of life. Endometrial cancer can cause symptoms such as pain, fatigue, swelling, loss of appetite, and weight changes, to mention a few. Treatment can also cause these side effects. We know that chemotherapy may cause hair loss, nausea, neuropathy, body aches, and fatigue. Immunotherapy can also cause inflammation of organs such as the thyroid, intestines, lungs, liver, and skin. These side effects are often manageable, but early communication is critical as these side effects can be treated with steroids or holding, stopping, or reducing your therapy. One of the most powerful tools in cancer care is communication. We cannot treat symptoms we do not know about. Early reporting allows us to intervene before symptoms become severe. Many patients hesitate to report side effects because they don't want to complain, they don't want to delay treatment, or think that the symptoms are normal. However, early reporting allows us to intervene before symptoms become severe. Sometimes these symptoms can become intolerable and lead to multiple hospitalizations, and so that is why it's so important to communicate with your team so that we can try to prevent these things from happening. Pain management is an important part of care. The goal is not sedation. It is to function and have quality of life. Adjustments can always be made if side effects from medications occur, but again, it's a matter of having a communication with your team members. Many specialists also benefit from palliative care specialists. Palliative care focuses on symptom management and improving quality of life at any stage of illness alongside cancer treatment. Finally, I want to emphasize shared decision-making. Shared decision-making means you and your oncology team work together to create a plan that aligns with your medical needs and your personal goals along your treatment and after your treatment even. You're the expert on your body and on your life. When patients speak openly about their symptoms, concerns, and goals, care improves. Our job is not to just treat cancer. It is to treat the whole person. Thank you for being here. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ramirez. Just another incredibly informative presentation, especially highlighting the importance of communication, protecting quality of life, and a shared decision making. So thank you so much. I know that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Sarah Kerr, and Dr. Kerr is Chair, Department of Pathology, Abbott Northwestern Hospital, pathologist specializing in molecular genetic pathology, gynecologic and perinatal pathology, pulmonary pathology, and cytopathology, Hospital Pathology Associates and Alina Health, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Dr. Kerr will be discussing the important role of the pathologist in genetic and biomarker testing. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm so excited to go into more depth about pathology and how new biomarkers are informing pathology diagnosis and staging in endometrial cancer. So first of all, I'm a pathologist, which is a doctor who specializes in laboratory testing. And in endometrial cancer, your pathologist is involved in your care behind the scenes. So many of you had an endometrial biopsy at the beginning of your endometrial cancer journey, and that endometrial biopsy, that tissue, goes to the pathology laboratory where the tissue is processed into little blocks of wax that are cut into thin sections and put on glass slides to look at under a microscope. The pathologist recognizes whether there is cancer in the endometrium or something else that might be causing abnormal vaginal bleeding, like abnormal menstrual cycles or infection or polyp. And if there is cancer there, the pathologist needs to make sure it is coming from the endometrium and not somewhere nearby like the uterine cervix, which are very close together in the uterus. So if it is endometrial cancer, there are a number of types and grades of endometrial cancer that are important. So FIGO grade 1 endometrioid carcinoma is probably the most common type of endometrial cancer. And some patients who can't tolerate surgery immediately or need to preserve their uterus for fertility reasons sometimes are offered hormonal treatments for this particular type of endometrial cancer. But this being said, most endometrial cancers are managed with surgery, and so pathologists subdivide endometrial cancers based on the way they look at them under the microscope. And all of the various subtypes that we report out are, some examples are endometrioid carcinoma, clear cell carcinoma, serous carcinoma, and then there's some other rarer types that are almost always managed with surgery if possible. So when a surgery was performed, that tissue that's removed by the surgeon is also sent to the pathology laboratory where a team led by the pathologist examines the tissue both before we section it and then also under a microscope. And then the pathology report is made with the final tumor diagnosis and a staging report describing how far the cancer is spread. So something new that I want to talk about today that you might be reading about in your pathology reports is the molecular classification of endometrial cancer. Now, the molecular classification helps your team refine how they expect the tumor to behave beyond what we would have predicted based on just the microscope appearance alone. So pathologists for years have classified endometrial cancer with just a microscope and some special stains, and now there are these new biomarkers that help us more precisely determine what type of treatment, either sort of conservative or aggressive treatment, might be more appropriate. And these common tests are called POLE mutation testing, which is also known as polymerase epsilon, and is often reported with a tumor mutation burden, which tells us sort of how many mistakes are being made in the tumor DNA during division of the cancer cells. Another biomarker is mismatch repair enzymes, and the third biomarker is P53 status. So using these three tests, POLE, mismatch repair, and P53, we can use those biomarkers to assign a molecular classification on top of the pathology classification. And you might hear this also called the PROMIS classifier, which stands for Proactive Molecular Risk Classifier for Endometrial Cancer. And this classification then divides cancers into POLE mutant, or also called ultra-mutated, mismatch repair deficient, or also called microsatellite instability high, or P53 abnormal, or called serous-like or copy number high, and then those having no specific molecular profile based on the biomarkers. So I don't want to go into too much detail about the sort of individual molecular classifiers, but what I would say is that POLE-E mutant tumors are predicted to be the least aggressive, and so we're changing the way we think about these tumors to sometimes downstage the tumors based on them being assigned as a POLE-E mutant tumor, or on the other end, the aggressive end, P53 abnormal tumors tend to be the most aggressive based on the biomarker profile, and those are now sometimes upstaged depending on where the cancer is found in the uterus and other tissues. Another sort of important aspect of biomarker testing is the mismatch repair deficient tumors are sometimes associated with a familial risk of endometrial cancer, meaning that there might be endometrial cancer, colon cancer, other tumors that could run in your family if you have this tumor type and also have that mutation in all of the cells in your body called germline mutation. And so that syndrome is called Lynch syndrome. So that's something you might want to ask about if you have a mismatch repair deficient tumor, to make sure that you've received any appropriate genetic counseling and additional testing to identify whether your family is at risk for developing Lynch syndrome-associated tumors. Okay, so that was a lot about endometrial cancer pathology, and the information is changing really quickly, and so we're learning a lot about how to individualize treatments for patients based on the traditional pathology combined with the molecular classification, which is really exciting. And all of these pathology, biomarker, and staging details can be just really overwhelming to understand, even if you have a good medical background. And so because using some of these biomarkers is pretty new, it's likely that your doctors are also learning how to use these biomarkers like POLE-E and mismatch repair and P53, and learning how these affect staging and potentially modifying how they would have treated before and after knowing that biomarker information. So, I ask a lot of questions to your doctors about your pathology report and try to understand how your tumor would have been treated or staged with and without the new biomarker information. And also know that based on some of these new biomarkers, you might be eligible for clinical trials based on that biomarker information. So ask your team what might be available to you over standard options for treatment so that you have more options available to you. Okay, that's all I have for today. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. Again, a superb presentation. You covered a lot of information in a short amount of time. I know that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. And now I'm going to introduce our next speaker, and our next speaker is Corby Arthur. Ms. Arthur is an endometrial cancer patient, SHARE Uterine Cancer Patient Support Coordinator at SHARE Cancer Support, who we are happy to have and partner with on this program today. And Ms. Arthur will be discussing SHARE Cancer Support's free national programs and services, as well as their helpline and their website to access their programs and services. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Arthur.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction, Johnny. We're very pleased to have the opportunity to partner with Cancer Care on today's educational program. SHARE is a national nonprofit that supports, educates, and empowers women affected by uterine, ovarian, cervical, and breast cancers. Our uterine cancer program, which covers both endometrial and uterine sarcomas, offers a variety of free services. We offer 8 different peer-led uterine cancer support groups, which are currently being held via Zoom. Support groups are a low-pressure, empowering opportunity to exchange experiences, information, and care with other people who have uterine cancer. Our support group program includes a general uterine cancer support group for people at various stages of the journey, a newly diagnosed and in treatment, metastatic uterine cancer, gynecologic cancer support for women of African descent, gynecologic cancer support for immunotherapy patients, NSMP for people who have uterine cancer in the no specific molecular profile category, young women's gynecologic cancer support, and we also have support groups for women who speak Spanish or Chinese. Our uterine cancer helpline is staffed by trained uterine cancer survivors who can lend support, give information, and share experiences. That number is 844-582-6005. SHARE also holds online educational webinars as well as additional programming throughout the year, including events like today's where we partner with other organizations. Our webinars provide the latest information about uterine and endometrial cancer, research, and treatment, as well as strategies for maintaining well-being and quality of life, and are led by top oncologists and experts in the field. A library of recorded webinars can be found on our website, sharecancersupport.org. So the takeaway is knowledge is power, and SHARE Uterine Cancer Support is here for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Arthur, for that incredible introduction and overview of SHARE Cancer Support. It's a really wonderful resource for our participants. And I want to make note that for those listening today, you will receive an email including resources that were mentioned on this program in about a week to 10 days from now. So anything that was mentioned on this workshop will be included on that email. All right, and I'm going to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Sarah Whalen. Ms. Whalen is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and Ms. Whalen will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our helpline and website. It is now my great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Ms. Whalen.
Hi, Johnny. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. Hi, everybody else. My name is Sarah Whalen, pronouns she, her, and I'm the internship program coordinator as well as oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops like this today, publications, and limited financial assistance. There are many aspects of an endometrial cancer diagnosis that may be addressed throughout psychosocial supportive services, making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, fertility options, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker. Individuals diagnosed with endometrial cancer may choose to supplement their existing social networks by choosing to join a support group or engaging in counseling services. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to connect with others who are going through a similar situation, obtain information, and provide support. Currently, Cancer Cares offers a specific GYN, so gynecologic cancer, online support group. The GYN support group reduces feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explores new ways of coping, increases feelings of empowerment, provides practical information about treatment and resources, and helps you communicate better with your medical team and your loved ones. Our online support groups take place on a password-protected website and are moderated by licensed oncology social workers who can offer further support and guidance. You can register for one of our online support groups through our website, which is cancercare.org. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment. So if you are encountering these hardships, there are organizations that are out there to help you. As mentioned earlier, Cancer Care offers resource navigation services as well as limited financial assistance. If you are navigating any of practical or financial concerns, I encourage you to call our national helpline at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. We are here to offer you support throughout this experience and are looking forward to speaking with you soon. It has been such a pleasure to be a part of this program, and I will now turn it back over to Ms. Nazarian.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Just a wonderful and incredibly comprehensive overview of all the resources that we offer here at Cancer Care. Thank you so much again, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Now we are going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Thank you, Bella. All right, here is our first question. It's for Ms. Whalen. Can you discuss coping after surgery, in my case, hysterectomy? I haven't really felt like myself since.
Thank you so much for that question. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to those feelings. After a diagnosis of endometrial cancer and a hysterectomy, it's super understandable to feel unlike yourself. You've been through something physically and emotionally overwhelming, and recovery isn't just about the physical recovery or the incision healing. There can be fear, grief, hormone shifts, fatigue, and a sense that your body and even your identity has changed. Nothing about that means that you're coping poorly. It just means that you're processing a lot. I encourage you to be super gentle with yourself. Speak openly about your mood or menopausal symptoms with your doctor, and definitely consider counseling your cancer support group if it feels helpful to connect with people who truly understand. Feeling off right now doesn't mean that it's permanent. Both physical and emotional healing do take time, and you definitely don't have to do it alone. So I appreciate you asking that question, and I hope that you can find some support that would be helpful during this time. Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah. That's a wonderful answer. Thank you. And we have a question here. It's for Dr. Haight. The question is, I was HER2 positive breast cancer, so diagnosed with HER2 positive breast cancer. Can I get HER2 positive endometrial cancer?
That's a really great question. Most often that HER2 genetic mutation is going to be something that we see somatically, or essentially that means it's sporadic or associated with the tumor itself and not necessarily like a germline or a genetic mutation that all of your cells carry. It would definitely be possible for you to have a HER2 positive endometrial cancer, but I wouldn't say it's, necessarily definitive. If that makes sense.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haight. Okay, and we have a question for Dr. Ramirez. How is metformin used in treatment for endometrial cancer?
Yes, metformin is used in treatment for endometrial cancer, typically not as a standard of care, but sometimes with patients with hormonal markers in their endometrial cancer, so usually like endometrioid endometrial cancer, for example, ER positive, we can use metformin with as a treatment with adjuvant hormonal treatment, but not as just a sole treatment for endometrial cancer. So it is not standard of care for endometrial cancer, but sometimes used as an adjuvant, for example, when patients are being treated with other hormonal therapies. But again, it's not a standard of care.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Ramirez. I have a question for Dr. Haight. How does endometrial cancer typically advance? Can it happen through the lymph nodes? And what are the most common sites?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Endometrial cancer typically is going to progress or metastasize. One of the first ways we think about it doing that is via the lymph nodes or through lymphovascular invasion. So essentially, endometrial cancer tends to travel to those lymph nodes either in the pelvis or the aorta first. Other places that it can metastasize would be, other locations inside of the abdomen. Sometimes our higher histology or higher risk histology cancers are at a, you know, have a greater chance of metastasizing to places like the omentum, which is the fat pad that overlies the bowel. The liver is a place that we will see, or potentially the lung.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Haight. I have an additional question for you as well. So how does the evaluation of circulating tumor cells impact treatment?
That's a really great question, and something that we're actually, you know, really trying to figure out ourselves. Circulating tumor DNA, for those of you who don't know, essentially is a blood test that is very personalized to a patient's particular tumor. And it helps detect molecular residual disease. And so essentially it's a blood test that you would get that could be, you know, negative, meaning it may be reassuring that there's not molecular residual cancer within the body, versus positive could potentially be concerning for persistent disease. ctDNA is currently FDA approved to be utilized in the surveillance setting for patients that are getting immunotherapy for any type of cancer. So that's endometrial cancer included. Although I will say that we don't really have any great studies as of yet that have truly validated the utility of ctDNA in endometrial cancer. And so it's something that's sort of challenging. Like if a patient were to come to me with a negative result that turned to a positive, you know, I can't tell them for certain that that's necessarily related to disease recurrence without proof of that on CT scans, but it's something that we're working on studying.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haight. I have a question here for Dr. Ramirez. Is it possible at relapse to have immunotherapy and not need surgery and radiation?
So just to confirm, the question is, if a patient has relapsed with endometrial cancer, is it possible to treat solely with immunotherapy and not chemotherapy,
yes,
radiation? Okay. That's a great question. It really depends, but typically, you know, if a patient has relapsed or recurred in their endometrial cancer, it really is going to depend on where the patient has recurred. Where they are in their treatment course. For example, if they only got surgery initially and then they had cancer recur at that time, we need to determine where the patient is recurred. And typically, the answer to this question is that we will more than likely treat with chemotherapy and a combination of immunotherapy for recurrent and metastatic endometrial cancer, and not just immunotherapy alone. But again, every situation can be, you know, standardized, but typically it is just a combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Ramirez. And now I'm going to ask each of our speakers to provide a takeaway. So first we're going to start with Dr. Richardson, then Dr. Haight, Dr. Ramirez, Ms. Arthur, and Ms. Whalen. So Dr. Richardson, can you please provide just a minute takeaway? All right, we'll actually move on to Dr. Haight. If you could please provide just a 1 minute takeaway for our participants.
Yeah, of course. As you all can see, you know, metastatic endometrial cancer, while it remains a serious diagnosis, the landscape of treatment has changed really dramatically over the last couple of years. We now have treatments that are more effective, more personalized, and in a lot of cases better tolerated than traditional chemotherapy alone, which is really exciting.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Ramirez?
I think it's important to remember that there is no way to prevent endometrial cancer. I mean, meaning like there's no pap smear or mammogram that a woman can get to identify whether they have endometrial cancer. And so really listening to your body and talking to your doctor when there's concerns is imperative and crucial to identify when you need to get a biopsy and when you need to get imaging to determine what do you have endometrial cancer, so we can identify earlier, diagnose earlier, and treat. And again, I agree, the landscape is changing. There's so many ways and so many other treatments available than there were even 10, 15 years ago. So it is an exciting time for clinical trials and research in endometrial cancer. And we're thankful for the ability to take care of our patients every day. So thank you for this opportunity as well.
Thank you, Dr. Ramirez. And Ms. Arthur, your takeaway?
Sure. Knowledge is power, and SHARE Uterine Cancer Support is here for you. I want to repeat, our website is sharecancersupport.org, and then go to uterine cancer. If you have want to email us, you can email us at uterineprogram@sharecancersupport.org. And our number, helpline number, is 844-582-6005. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you so much, Ms. Arthur. And Ms. Whalen?
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to thank all of the speakers today. I think this was such a wonderful and informative program. I would say that in terms of the main takeaway for me is that there's so much support out there. So between Cancer Care, SHARE, and so many other organizations, if you are looking for support, you will find it. And just to repeat, Cancer Care's Hope Line is 800-813-4673, and you can connect with an oncology social worker who can direct you in the support that you're looking for. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Whalen. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal today. I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was exceptional because of the questions asked on the call and the way our speakers addressed those questions. Now, I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you who didn't have your question answered. I would like you to go back to your health team and ask them your question. Remember, you've learned a great deal from today's program, so I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question again and again. I also do want to remind everybody that it is important to know who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. We hear that sometimes things come up and you don't know who to reach during those times, so it's important to know who to reach at all times, especially evenings, weekends, and holidays. And lastly, I just want to mention, I don't want anyone to leave this program feeling that they are alone, because you are not alone. Just to echo what Sarah and Ms. Whalen said, you have a community support of support here at Cancer Care, at SHARE Cancer Support, and there are a lot of resources out there for you as well. Again, I do appreciate your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.